So have you heard the one about a psychiatrist, a Supreme Court judge and a moral philosopher? Well, they walked into a radio studio and the rest is for today's listening. Natasha Mitchell on board for All in the Mind on ABC Radio National. Thanks for tuning in. A unique roundtable today on the nature of addiction.
There's two sorts of identities, public identities, that addicts are allowed to have, and one's the sort of the medical identity that they've got an illness or a disease, and that carries with it the risk they'll be seen as incapable of making decisions and incapable of taking responsibility, and that's got clear ethical implications. And the other publicly available identity is that they're just bad. Addiction, the term itself, carries a lot of moral implications. So it looks like there's two ways we can go. We can go the disease model, we can go the moral model, and there's not much in between. My hope is that the neuroscience can actually encourage us into a conversation where we get, you know, a more enriched and subtle picture about what's going on. The fear is that the neuroscience will leave the person out of the picture.
Professor Jeanette Kennett, author of Agency and Responsibility, A Common Sense Moral Psychology. She's with the Macquarie Centre for Cognitive Science and the Philosophy Department at Macquarie University, who with the University of Melbourne this week hosted a symposium called Addiction, Identity and Responsibility. The journal Lancet has just reported that 1 in 25 of us worldwide between the age of 15 and 64 use cannabis, for example, and that around 9% of us who've used will become dependent. And as neuroscience cracks apace to understand addiction, how should we think about the addicted brain? Hijacked by drugs or a maker of choices? Is it ever that clear cut? What about questions of individual culpability, responsibility and self-control? Joining Jeanette today is David Hodgson, a Judge of Appeal of the Supreme Court of New South Wales and a philosopher by night. His books include The Mind Matters and Consequences of Utilitarianism. And Associate Professor Dan Lubman is an addiction psychiatrist and clinical researcher with Origin Youth Health Research Centre in Melbourne. And thanks to you all for joining me on ABC Radio National.
Thank you.
Look, addiction certainly has become a massive focus for the neurosciences, for psychiatry. I had Nora Volkov on the show a while back. She's the neuroscientist who heads up the National Institute on Drug Abuse in the US and whose research has been really key in framing addiction as a brain disease. And I imagine that for each of you in your very different domains of work, to call addiction a disease raises some quite distinct questions. Can I come to you, Dan Lubman, as a clinical researcher and psychiatrist working with young people who are addicted? What does it mean to call addiction a brain disease for you?
Well, I think that's a really important question. Certainly where we come from in terms of looking at people who develop problems with alcohol and drugs, we're talking about, you know, a particular type of pattern behaviour where repeated drug use, repeated drinking leads to significant harms, despite knowledge that that's actually causing a lot of problems and a lot of impairment in areas of their life, such as their family, friends, work, financially or legally. There's also a recognition that they need to do something about it, that they actually want to cut down or stop using, but despite doing that, they find that they fail to do that. So it's a repeated failed attempt to actually reduce or stop using. And associated with that, there's sort of a preoccupation with that behaviour. So everything else in the life becomes less important and there's a focus on taking the drug and using the drug and everything else sort of loses significance.
David Hodgson, is the description of addiction as a brain disease already having a tangible impact in the courts? Certainly we've seen the development of drug courts, of specialist mental health courts, recognising that people have different degrees of capability when it comes to their ability to assess their own actions and their criminality of those actions.
Yes, I think that view of addiction is having an impact. My own view is when addiction is associated with criminal conduct, one mustn't regard it as just a disease. I think one still has to keep in mind the moral aspect of what's been done. And I think it is important to generally regard them as having responsibility for criminal conduct, but then in deciding what is the best way to respond to criminal conduct, have regard to the fact that degrees of responsibility may be reduced, and also have regard to the fact that if someone who's committed a crime because of addiction is willing to undergo treatment and undergo programs to overcome addiction, that can be a very good reason for not punishing in the same way as other people, perhaps postponing the question of whether there's to be punishment, leaving that to see if they are able to address their addiction in a good way.
Dan, I think you want to come in here.
I mean, I think it raises the issues if we think of addiction as some sort of health problem. Then we need to sort of examine the way in which the legal frameworks in which we consider the disorder and how we, whether we criminalise or decriminalise certain types of behaviour. And obviously David's in a position where he has to enforce the law based on how it's constructed. But certainly we can think about how we might put an argument to policymakers about how the law should be put together when we think about addiction as a health problem.
David, this is interesting for you because a central question for you here focuses on the retributive nature of our criminal law system, which considers that people are punished because they deserve to be held accountable for the actions they're responsible for.
And my contention is that that's generally a good thing, because if we don't punish people because they deserve it, then there's less reason to refrain from punishing people who don't deserve it. And it seems to me that the retributive view of punishment is really an essential limitation on the application of punishment. If we regard punishment as purely to achieve good ends and not depending on proving that someone's done something to deserve it, then one's heading in a bad direction towards, say, putting people in prison because you think their ideas are dangerous.
Jeanette Kennett.
It's a double-edged sword, isn't it? Because if we classify it as a disease and say, well, it reduces responsibility to a certain point where treatment is the appropriate option rather than punishment, which seems much more humane, you do also bring up other issues about compulsory treatment, about the capacity of addicts to consent to treatment, and you would have to be very careful about what kind of system you institute, that it's not worse in terms of infringing the rights of those individuals. So I think there really is a big issue there. Another issue for policymakers, the challenge that was thrown down yesterday by Alex Wodak of St Vincent's Hospital, who pointed out that addiction problems differentially affect people in socially disadvantaged situations, who are also the people that we find in prison.
So it's not just about individual brains here, is it? We're talking about a whole context within which our individual brains operate.
That's right. And the interesting question for us is, what can neuroscience add to our understanding that the other social sciences haven't already provided us with?
Well, before we come to the neuroscience, Jeanette Kennett, as a moral philosopher, certainly to call a chronic addiction a disease is to imply that it's organic, that in effect it happens to us. We might be involved in that happening, but certainly we eventually ultimately become a victim or a sufferer of the disease. And I wonder, for you as a philosopher, does that raise fundamental questions about the contingent nature of our agency, our autonomy? So stepping into the philosophical realm here.
I think that we have to accept that our autonomy is not just an individual achievement, that all of us depend on other people to allow us to express our own agency, to do the things that we want to do. If you think about your goals in life, what you value, autonomy is about being able to make progress towards those goals. And illnesses of various sorts can undermine your capacity to do so in various ways. But if you think about those goals, you realise that, of course, they're subject to all sorts of contingencies, not just the contingencies of accident or illness, but social contingencies. So it does make you think about how much you need other people in order to do what you want to do. I think that there have been, in the past in philosophy, fairly crude conceptions of autonomy that see it as all up to you, all as it were, inside the head and not outside the head.
And you've got it or you haven't.
Yes, that, you know, there might be something like an on-off switch, but autonomy too, like responsibility, comes in degrees, and it very much relies on social support, social scaffolding. So what I hope to see is in the sort of social neurosciences is a lot of attention paid to the ways in which the social gets inside the head, as it were.
But this notion of agency, which has preoccupied philosophers for centuries, and I perhaps linked in some way to the concept of volition and that sense of control that we have as an agent over the consequences of our actions. I mean, why is it so crucial to this conversation about addiction?
It's crucial if people with drug problems experience a sense of loss of control. If they, either due to, you know, the cravings that they're experiencing or other things that are going on in their life, feel that they cannot make their lives go the way they would want them to go. And if you feel that you can't achieve the things that you value, you might lose a lot of hope. So then you focus on what is available to you, and often the one good thing that might be available to you, the one old reliable that will make you feel good right here and now, is going to be drugs. So you become, I guess, a different sort of agent. Our agency in general, we've got a picture of ourselves as existing across time, of being this kind of person doing this kind of thing with this kind of goals. And I think that chronic drug use can kind of shrink that picture back and make you into a very short-term kind of individual, in part because maybe you think you can't achieve those longer-term goods.
And we're talking agency, addiction and the law on All in the Mind today. Philosopher Jeanette Kennett, New South Wales Supreme Court Judge David Hodgson and addiction psychiatrist Dan Lubman are my guests here on ABC Radio National, globally on Radio Australia and as podcast. Dan Lubman, your research, I think, is reflecting very interestingly on this conversation about agency and how people perhaps lose a degree of agency when they're swallowed up by an addiction. So neuroscience is making some interesting headroads here, isn't it? One model of the findings is that addictive drugs hijack the system in our brain that responds to rewards like drugs, like chocolate, like sex, and our behaviour is biased towards further drug use. Tell us, what does it mean to say that the brain's reward system has been hijacked? Interesting language there.
It certainly is, and certainly it's been very exciting in the neuroscience field over the past, particularly over the last 20 years, to see our understanding of how drugs impact on the brain and how regular drug use changes the brain in specific ways. What you're talking about is there's a key part of the brain that we know that is important for highlighting really significant things in our environment that we need to pay attention to. And that system, that the brain's reward system, fires off a chemical called dopamine when there's something important that we need to pay attention to. And certainly things that are key behaviours for survival, like eating, drinking, procreating, nurturing our young, those behaviours certainly fire off that system and ensure that we survive as an individuals and as a species. And this system links very closely to the emotional part of the brain. It's very much linked to learning and memories, and it's also closely linked as well to the frontal parts of the brain involved in sort of those notions of goals in terms of motivation, weighing up the future, where you want to go, how you want to regulate sort of the things you want to aim for in life.
And importantly, that region, the whole sort of front executive part of the brain, is about controlling our behaviour too.
Definitely. It's about really informed decision making. And so what we now know is that all the drugs that we use in our society, all the drugs of abuse, including alcohol,
or drugs of use, depending on your point of view.
That's right. But what's common to all those drugs is they cause a huge increase in the level of dopamine within that system.
And dopamine overdrive.
That's right.
But the consequences are lasting. This has been more recent work that's been very interesting.
I suppose the question is what happens when you start taking that drug on a regular basis? Certainly we all experience dopamine release every day.
We need it.
Variety, exactly.
That's right.
It's part of why we find life interesting. But if we continue to use certain drugs on a regular heavy pattern over a long period of time, what we see is major changes within this part of the brain. Situations, places, people that remind us of drugs, they become much more important and are able to drive the system. So the motivation to use drugs becomes much more important. At the same time, what we find is that this system becomes sort of less sensitive to natural rewards, natural reinforcers, things that you and I would find pleasant and pleasurable.
And some people refer to that as a sort of the set point for the reward system in the brain is sort of reconfigured, it's shifted to the right.
That's right. And there's some fundamental questions we still don't know. We still don't know to what degree does that change with long-term abstinence, to what degree does recovery occur in those brain systems.
Another aspect of your work is also focusing on the brain's so-called inhibitory control mechanisms. So again, regions at the front executive part of the brain are also affected, and this is quite key. This might explain why people keep searching for a hit even though the consequences become absolutely dire. Life-threatening.
What we consistently find across a whole range of people who have alcohol and drug problems is that this frontal part of the brain, the part of the brain involved in regulating behaviour, involved in making decisions about short-term versus long-term goals, what we find consistently is that part of the brain is impaired. That's not to say, though, that in the experiments that we've done, that sort of in the cold light of day, people with long-term addictions make, you know, are able to sort of inhibit their behaviour and make good choices.
So they're not total automatons, that you're not inferring that?
Certainly not.
Because the implication could be taken that we're just beholden to our brain, our impaired brain.
Exactly. And I think, you know, the notion of loss and control could be sort of overemphasised. I think it's, in some ways, what we describe is more of a relative loss of control in certain situations.
Do you see self-control purely in terms of individual brain function?
Well, I mean, I think that's a really important issue that, you know, Jeanette's touched on, the issue of social neuroscience. So now we're starting to ask much more sophisticated questions around, well, how does the brain change in the context of a social group or social situation? How do environmental situations change that brain and influence that brain? And how does that then lead to decisions around drugs and drug taking?
Yeah. David Hodgson, can I come to you? I guess you don't think in your courtroom of a mass of brains, mass of individual brains standing before you. You're thinking of them in their entirety.
That's right. We view people as whole persons, and I think the categories the law uses are all, as it were, folk psychological categories. Categories like beliefs, intentions and motives and wishes, desires, etc. But ultimately the courts have to decide in accordance with categories like, was this an intentional action? Was this person able to control himself or herself? Which are not the categories that are used by neuroscientists.
Certainly you suggest that some see neuroscience sounding a death knell for notions of free will and responsibility, and particularly in the context of the legal system, I would imagine. So what lies at the heart of that concern?
I'm thinking of some philosophers and psychologists who say that neuroscience is demonstrating that the brain is just a machine and any idea of free will is just an illusion, and that ultimately you've got to do away with these ideas of responsibility and desert and just approach the question of criminal conduct from a purely consequentialist point of view. What action in relation to people who engage in such conduct will have the best consequences without really worrying whether they were actually responsible for what they did.
What do you think? I mean, do you think neuroscience poses a real threat to notions of individual free will and responsibility in your philosophical life, but also in the setting in which you work as a Supreme Court judge?
I think not. I think opposing views are sufficiently robust to resist this sort of argument from neuroscientists and psychologists and some philosophers. I think the most prominent philosophical view that it's quite consistent with a deterministic view of the brain, that persons as whole people can have free will in the sense of having the capacity to recognise and respond to good reasons for conduct and to control their conduct accordingly, and that's all quite consistent with determinism. That's a very robustly held view by perhaps a majority of philosophers. I don't wholly support that view. I am one person who disagrees with determinism, and I think we do have a free will that can transcend determinism.
The assumption here is that, though, that most of us make decisions with reason and with clear conscious intention all the time, and with a sense of our own agency. Is that really the case?
Well, I think it is. I mean, undoubtedly, an awful lot of our decision-making does happen unconsciously, but I think in our conscious thinking and action, there is a sense in which people are in control of what they think and what they do.
Even if they are chronically addicted to a substance that has, and we used this expression before, hijacked their brain.
Well, I think this control and ability to reason does come in degrees, and certainly addiction and other problems can considerably reduce the degree of capacity to reason well and to control our actions.
Jeanette Kennett, looking at addiction, I mean, historically addiction has been cast as a sign of a weak character, as a sort of defect of will, and that somehow a person has somehow lost an internal battle between reason and desire. They've lost control and succumbed to the desire for a high. Tease that out for us in terms of how we then judge whether they are responsible for what they do under the influence.
I think that certainly, as Dan's pointed out, there are cases in which your capacity for reflection and to control your action gets sort of worn down by repeated cravings. It could be true that for some people, they've got just as much willpower as you or I, maybe more, but they've got more to fight against.
It's interesting you say that, because that's certainly the thinking of a lot of philosophers and cognitive psychologists now, isn't it? That to see self-control not as a sort of black or white thing, you've got it or you haven't, but rather as a sort of cognitive resource to be depleted or
That's
replenished,
right.
depending on their circumstances.
It's a sort of a muscle metaphor. I mean, there's been work done in social psychology that indicates that if somebody's already done a kind of a task in a lab which requires a bit of self-control, you know, resisting freshly baked cookies and just eating radishes or something like that, then on your next self-control task, you'll perform worse than somebody who didn't have to restrain themselves earlier. So that suggests that there's this resource that gets depleted if there are repeated demands made on the person. There's also the idea there, though, maybe more hopeful, that if it is like a muscle, you can build it up with repeated practice and you can replenish it by resting, for example. So that's a metaphor that is in use and sort of fits with certain folk psychological notions and philosophical notions about self-control and about the will.
That's a metaphor. Dan Lubman, what do you think of that clinically when you're working with young people who are facing the sort of onslaught of drug use that they're experiencing?
I mean, I think there's a lot of similarities between what Jeanette talks about and what we find both clinically and in our research study. Certainly, we know it's this, I suppose, concept of cold cognition. So in the cold light of day, when we have to make decisions, when we have to think about everything, the impact of the drugs that are having on us, how it impacts on our goals and where we want to go, the people I see are really quite adamant about the fact that they're sick and tired of their drug use and they want to make changes and they want to work towards all these other important goals in their life. The issue then comes the issue of hot cognition. So what happens at times when there's a lot of other emotions or stressors or other things going on in their life? And some of the imaging studies that we've done quite clearly show that when we ask people long-term addicted to actually inhibit their response on certain quite complicated tasks, they perform at the same level as other people in the community. But when we look within their brains, they're actually having to sort of recruit much more of their brain to be able to function at the same level. there's not enough cognitive capacity to be able sometimes to inhibit those urges and desires, and that at times can lead to sort of relapse to drug taking. Working with people, it's about explaining about how these things impact on the decision-making and impact on the behaviour. So effectively, what we do already in treatment is in some ways act as this sort of external frontal lobe where we sort of work with people to increase their ability to sort of regulate their behaviour. So we work at building that part of the brain. They themselves are able to build up that part of their ability to cope in those situations.
So you're directly working with their own sense of agency and control. Implicit in the therapy is that, that belief.
That's right.
David Hodgson, you suggest that this sort of research and neuroscience more broadly shouldn't result in us abandoning notions of criminal responsibility. But you do still see some use for neuroscience in the courts, don't you?
Undoubtedly. It may be that in some respects neuroscience may enable us to improve some of the categories we use, like the insanity defence. It may be that neuroscience could help us define these things a bit more clearly, although I certainly neuroscientific evidence will be important, but it won't displace the need to make common sense judgments about responsibility. And of course, I think neuroscience will also be important in increasing understanding of what can be done to help people rehabilitate.
Dan, what do you think of that?
At the moment, we're in a stage of really trying to work out what is going on in addiction. And often we do lump everyone together and saying, you know, everybody who's addicted is the same. Certainly that's not the case clinically when you work with people. People can come into addiction from a whole range of different reasons. And understanding pathways into addiction is critically important because sometimes we're so focused on the addiction, we're not focused on the fact that there's some underlying trauma, some underlying mental health problems, issues with head injuries or other issues that are going on that are driving people into addiction. And it's the combination of those that is making things much more difficult and affecting the way in which they make decisions.
So we've got to think of the brain in its social context, but also in a lifelong context.
That's right.
The continuum of time. Jeanette, how can this conversation, just to wrap, inform and guide policy decisions around addiction?
Look, I really think that we have to look at the legal framework and the criminalisation of this behaviour, because it seems to me that that is unhelpful. I mean, I want to distinguish here between criminal conduct that might be associated with drug taking and the drug taking itself here, but I think that we have to look at this in a different light and think about how we can help the person become more whole, become more autonomous. And one of our speakers pointed out yesterday that the definition of addiction in the DSM-4,
the key diagnostic manual used by psychiatrists,
is that the drug-taking behaviour continues despite the person's knowledge of the bad consequences. Now, the point was made that if you then go and punish people for this behaviour, it's not going to act as a deterrent. They've already showed that they will continue using despite the bad consequences.
What's interesting at the moment and the work that's happening in the neuroscience field is looking at what type of manipulations we can make to change the way in which the reward system operates. And certainly that has policy implications, because once somebody becomes addicted, putting them in environments where they're repeatedly punished doesn't really seem to change that addictive behaviour. What does change dopamine is putting people in enriched environments, putting them in situations where there's more opportunities. And that's a much more likely that what we're learning from the neuroscience field in terms of both protecting people from developing addictive problems, but also in terms of moving towards recovery.
Well, so much there to think about. Thank you very much, Professor Jeanette Kennett, Associate Professor Dan Lubman, and Justice David Hodgson. Thank you for joining us on ABC Radio National.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And Dan Lubman is an addiction psychiatrist with Origin Youth Health Research Centre in Melbourne. Jeanette Kennett is at Macquarie University's Philosophy Department in the Centre for Cognitive Science. David Hodgson is a judge of the Supreme Court of Appeal in New South Wales and a philosopher by night. The audio transcript and lots of links and references go up on the All in the Mind website at abc.net.au/rn/allinthemind. And I'm sure you've got opinions. Let it rip. Email us via the website, or even better, be part of a wider conversation and click through to the All in the Mind blog and add your comments there. Thanks to co-producer Anita Barrow, studio engineer Andy Grant. I'm Natasha Mitchell. Next week, The Eyes Have It.
The ABC now has a big diary.
abc.net.au/thebigdiary.
It's like a big community events file.
Online.
You can go there and check out your local events and everything that's happening around Australia. And like any good diary, you can add your own events. That's how it works. The more events added to the big diary, the bigger it becomes. To find out what's there and just how big it is, go to abc.net.au/thebigdiary.